Friends, just as we gear ourselves up, the Reap On competition, there is a prize, and someone's donated an iPad, and so it's an iPad 32, I think. That's for free if you win the Reap On competition. So there you go. Just give that to you. Now, friends, I've worked out what I want to do if I get to 100 years. I've worked out how to celebrate that. Bungee jump. I know that there's an issue with teeth, but when you get to that age, you just take them out and put them on the side of the bed anyway. And so I thought I'd go and bungee jump. I've had this now, I've cherished this thought for 25 years. That's when I first read about another guy who, when he reached 100, celebrated by doing a bungee jump in New Zealand. It was big news for the town in which he was doing it, and so all the media turned up, you know, TV, radio, and papers and so on, and they found people to interview. They found this man's children, 75-year-old son, 73-year-old daughter, and asked them what they thought of their father doing this bungee jump on his 100th. And they said, well, we tried to talk him out of it, but, you know, his dad, he gets his own way anyway, and so... But they said, isn't there a blood rush, you know, like when you go down, the blood rushes to your head, can come out your eyeballs. They said, yeah, we talked about that, but he's after a blood rush, and so what could we do? We couldn't stop him. And so the organisers made sure he took his teeth out, strapped him up, and away he went. That's such an audacious act, isn't it? I thought, I'd want to do that. And who wouldn't want to bungee jump when you get to 100? Well, maybe you don't. And you think, if the blood does rush to your head and comes out your eyeballs or the rope snaps, it's fine. You get to leave a mark on the earth before you leave. I think that'd be great. Audacity is an attractive thing, it seems to me. Do you remember, if you're old enough, I sound like an old man here, but if you're old enough to remember the Tiananmen Square incident where one young Chinese student brought the might of the Chinese army to a standstill by standing in front of a tank. And when the tank wanted to go around him, you remember what he did? Can you see the tape playing in your head? He just moved to the side with his bags and stood there. And the army was brought to a standstill. His audacity brought the world to a breathtaking moment. In my early years as a Christ follower, I remember reading about some persecution around the world, and one that stood out was a persecution that took place again in China. Christians in a particular region were gathered together and they were made to march past a painting of Jesus and they were told to spit on the face of Jesus or they would be killed then and there. And so one by one people filed past and spat on the face of Jesus until a Chinese woman came. She knelt down and with tears in her eyes took her sleeve and wiped all the spittle off Jesus' face. The audacity of that young woman has captured a couple of generations of Christians to inspire them for decades to be audacious. What if a moment came to be audacious? What if a moment came to be audacious for Jesus? And you freeze. And the moment passes. A number of years ago, in my undergraduate days, I worked at a factory on the factory floor, and I used to wear T-shirts, because that's what you do when you're young and full of beans. You know, you wear T-shirts that have religious signs on them. One day, someone asked me in a group of men, what does that mean? A moment for audacity. And I froze. And they all went and walked away. What if you turn the corner one day and you see the finish line coming? You get to the age of 45 or 55 or 75 and the end of your race is coming. You turn the corner, you're wearing your Lorna Jane gear or you've got your skins on, your Lycra shorts, you're trotting up there looking just fantastic. And as you do, you notice that a sister from the Sudan comes up beside you and she bears the scars of torture on her neck and on her face. And you ask, what's that? What happened? I lived audaciously for Jesus and the government beat me to death. And as she finishes saying that, on your other shoulder, a Syrian pastor runs up beside you and you see on him the fresh marks of death and you ask, what happened to you? I turned my back on Islam and turned to Jesus. And the government demanded I turn back to Allah, but I refused. I lived audaciously and they killed me. You look up to the finish line and somewhat familiar figure kind of standing there. You can't quite make out who this person is until he takes his hands out of his robes and he begins to clap. With nail-scarred hands, he is applauding the three of you as you run towards the finish line. What if at that moment your blood runs cold with the realization that your life has slipped by without seeing God use you, without you stepping up for Jesus, holding your ground like the sister on this shoulder or the brother on this shoulder? We're in a series called Run. The writer of the Hebrews, in key verses, Hebrews 12, 1 and 2 says, therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, these are the ones who have run before, the legends of the track and people we don't know, but they've run before and they've been audacious. These people sit in the grandstands as we are now on the racetrack. Since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us tear off everything that trips us up and the sin that so easily entangles us and run with perseverance the race that has been marked out for you. You run, he says. You run. We've heard from legends of the track like Abraham and Moses, and today the microphone is handed to someone not so well known. His name is Jephthah. And if you know anything about Jephthah, it's an infamous vow which we will come back to. But first let's hear from the writer to the Hebrews, where Jephthah is mentioned. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 32.
Now faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. Now verse 32. And what shall I say? I do not have time to tell about Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, and gained what was promised, who shut the mouths of lions, quenched the fury of the flames, and escaped the edge of the sword, whose weakness was turned to strength, and who became powerful in battle and routed foreign armies. Women received back their dead, raised to life again. Others were tortured and refused to be released, so that they might gain a better resurrection. Some faced jeers and flogging, while still others were chained and put in prison. They were stoned. They were sawed in two. They were put to death by the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, destitute, persecuted, and mistreated. The world was not worthy of them. They wandered in deserts and mountains and in caves and holes in the ground. These were all commended for their faith, yet none of them received what had been promised. God had planned something better for us, that only together with us would they be made perfect. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us.
Jephthah sits here. Do you see who sits around Jephthah? There's Barak and Samson and David and Samuel and the prophets. I thought we'd look at Jephthah because he's not that well known. His name is hard to say. Though I have to admit that earlier in this week, I had a small mutiny with those who are going to preach on Jephthah today, including myself. I thought I should take myself out the back and give myself a good talking to for daring to suggest that we preach on Jephthah, let alone put me on to preach on him. But it's interesting, you know, this week I've discovered that Jephthah is someone who has some very helpful and timely instruction for us who live in this city at this time. Jephthah is listed, if you have a look at verse 33, he's listed in part because through faith he conquered a kingdom. Or verse 34, we're told that because of his faith, he routed a foreign army. His story is laid out for us in Judges 11 and 12. We'll come to that later. But he sits in the grandstand now and he calls out, run. You can run. Run audaciously. Run confidently before Jesus. Believe him for the impossible. Don't settle for small dreams like building a million-dollar business empire or conquering the heights of Mount Everest on your 50th birthday. Don't simply toy with the idea of paying off your mortgage before you retire and then having enough to live off for the 30-odd years or so that you're retired. Dream big, Jephthah was saying. Live audaciously. A young preacher by the name of Stephen Furtick puts it this way: if you're not daring to believe God for the impossible, you're sleeping through some of the best parts of your life. Or, if the size of your vision for your life isn't intimidating to you, there's a fair chance it's insulting to God. Jephthah says, run audaciously. Play to win. And some of you, I hear my own voice in the opposition that is about to come. Time out. Like, John, seriously. I've been clawing my way up a mountain of work and stuff and washing all week. And I have another mountain range that's about to fall on me this afternoon. It comes to me before I get to work tomorrow. And you want me to run audaciously? Yeah, I'm reading your mail. I understand. The energy to run is depleting to the point that some will say they suffer from PTFD, post-traumatic faith disorder. You've stepped out in faith before. You've tried living audaciously and you've been significantly burned by some individual, some leader, some church. You've possibly lost money because you've invested it. It's not so much that you lost it, it's just that the way it was lost by people who weren't full of integrity or they weren't genuine. Or you suffer from post-traumatic faith disorder. There are some I know who felt the call to ministry, some I studied with, who sold up houses and moved their families sometimes interstate to come and join us at Moore College in Newtown. And they studied for some of them 6 months, 12 months, 2 or 3, 4 years. But now decades later, they suffer from post-traumatic faith disorder because they never were accepted for full-time ministry by our denomination or any denomination. They stepped out in faith, they got burned, and they are weary, and they suffer post-traumatic faith disorder. And all they want to do, maybe all you want to do, is fly under the radar and wait until the world ends. If that is you, or if you know someone like that, then what Jephthah calls out from the grandstands, that is for us. He says three things. The first is this: run audaciously. To run audaciously, don't let a victim mindset imprison you. Don't let a victim mindset imprison you. I'm going to be trying to be very careful here because I know that there are people in our midst who have been victims, real victims. But it seems to me that if you're not a victim of something, you're the odd one out nowadays. I want to be careful. Those who are real victims, listen carefully. Listen carefully. If anyone had cause to be a victim, it was Jephthah. If you can follow back to Judges chapter 11, listen to what the writer says there. Jephthah the Gileadite was a mighty warrior. His father was Gilead, that is the leader of the Gileadites. Now listen to this. His father was Gilead. His mother was a prostitute. Gilead's wife, that we're meant to read, not the prostitute, but Gilead's real wife, also bore him sons. And when they were grown up, they drove Jephthah away. You are not going to get any inheritance in our family, they said, because you are the son, it says in the text here, another woman. You are the son of a prostitute. Everything at the beginning of his life was wrong. His father had a one-nighter with a prostitute. He's the result. His half-brothers found out about that, found him to be an embarrassment, so they threw him out of the house and home. No one was there to protect him, not one, not even his father who put him in this predicament. Unfortunately, Jephthah is not the only one to suffer at the hands of others, is he? A number of us were raised in abusive settings. And sadder still, we are not the end of the trail. I suspect there will be more victims of abuse amongst us, even more than in our generation. I suspect I fear that there will be another two or three generations of people who are being abused in great numbers. Abuse is like a raging torrent that is adding its destructive force to the flood that threatens to tear our society to pieces. It will not be until the gospel of Jesus is listened to again that healing is brought to hearts and souls, and reconciliation is brought, even in the most atrocious of scenarios. Perpetrators and abusers ought to apologize, and where necessary, they should be brought to justice, and to precious ones such as those who are victims, to precious ones, Jephthah says, don't let your victim status imprison you. Apart from the professional help that you can get, cast your eyes off your past and put them on the God of your future. When it comes to running the race marked out for us, Jephthah calls out, run. Run audaciously. Do not let a victim label imprison you. Lift your eyes above your circumstances to the God who is in charge of your salvation and the salvation of the whole world. We read of that in Judges 11. Jephthah was facing the Amorite king, and in a letter to the Amorite king, who is very threatening, Jephthah rehearses God's history with God's people. It serves to strengthen Jephthah's firm conviction that God guided Israel from the Exodus, from Egypt through the Exodus to the Promised Land. God had also delivered Israel from the Amorites. And so Jephthah was saying God could deliver Israel again, this time from the Amorites. Now, I know it can be a bit confusing with the Marmites, the Vegemites, and Dick Smith's Aussie-mites. Don't worry, don't get tripped up by them. The key is this. Jephthah raised his eyes from his circumstances to see the God above circumstance. And that gave him strength to run audaciously. He took on the Amorites and he won. It matters not if you're a victim or whether you suffer from post-traumatic faith disorder. Both can lock you in a prison of pain filled with avoidance and apathetic indifference, once bitten, twice shy. But the way forward is not to stay there. The way forward is to lift your eyes to Jesus to see what he has done and what he will do. Friends, this is not easy, particularly it's not easy if you're trying to live the life Jesus wants and your past goes into a massive battle with your faith and your head hurts because memories of abuse do not ever totally fade away. An offhand comment, a random comment, sight or smell can bring your memories to full life again. And there is enough in Judges 11 and 12 to indicate that Jephthah never fully escaped his awful background and beginning either. But if we are to run the race marked out for us with perseverance, if we are to run the race and finish it, then we will need to lift our eyes from our circumstance and from our PDFD to see Jesus. And if Jephthah could do that, we can do it. All he had to go on was the Exodus and one battle with the Amorites. We have that and more. We have Jesus who came and was born this earth, lived on this earth, died here and rose from the dead. And we have all of the scriptures to go on. And on top of that, the very same spirit that was on Jephthah now lives in us. So we can do this. And I want to pause for just a moment. To those of you who wonder if anyone loves you or could love you, come to the foot of the cross and look up. Look up at the one who would rather die than live without you. The one who says, this is my demonstration of love for you. And then come to 1 John 3:1, where the apostle writes, look how much love the Father has lavished on us that we should be called children of God. For that is what we are. That is what we are. So take what Christ has done, is doing, and will do to build a conviction. Jesus has saved you. He will save you. Let that build a very firm conviction so that you can run audaciously, so that you can run to tell the world that Jesus is God, not your past, not your post-traumatic faith disorder, but Jesus is God. Run audaciously so that the world marvels and goes, do you know her background? Do you know his background? Do you see how he runs? His God, her God, must be a marvelous God for them to be able to run like that now. When we do this is the faith of Hebrews 11, 1 and 6. Believing what was yet to come, holding on to that which God promises. So run audaciously. To run audaciously may mean at work that when the work conference is on, you do what a number of men and women in this church do. They refuse to go to the after conference party for drunk orgies and so. Run audaciously. Maybe it means you stand up to the bully at work who's picking on the juniors or the young women or the older women, and you stand up to them and say, this is inappropriate in our workplace. Matters not if you're the boss. You stand up to the bullies. Maybe it means at school that you're not like an increasing number of parents who work every angle to give their children an unfair leg up to get them into the class that they want or to the sporting grade that they want. Because you know that it may well be the best thing to do, the best way to love your children, is let them experience a little disappointment in kindergarten. And teach them to lean into Jesus, lean into Jesus, and trust him when things don't go well. Because that lesson will help them mature and become men and women. Maybe to be audacious is that you take the dream that Jesus has placed in your heart and you run with it to build that halfway house for victims of domestic violence. So you build it. Maybe the dream is that you have a dream to sit with the bosses or the board of your company and pray with them. Maybe it's to be a bold and clear witness for Jesus in the office or at school, or to be the dad or the husband or the father or the grandfather or the wife that God wants you to be. You will run audaciously to honor Jesus at every point of your life. Run to be audacious, Jephthah says. But before we run past Jephthah in the turn, he calls out another thing. He calls out, secondly, watch the stupid meter. Watch the stupid meter. If we go to the next slide, thanks. Jephthah forgot his brain at one point. If you know anything about Jephthah, it was his stupid vow in Judges 11. He says to God, I tell you what, God, I'll go take the Amorites on, and if you give me the victory, then I'll sacrifice the first thing that comes out of my door when I get home. And the first thing that comes out of his door, if you remember the story, is his daughter, his only daughter, his only child. And at that point, the fathers amongst us, you think, you want to tap him on the head, you know, like, what were you thinking? What did you expect to come out of the house when you got home? A thief? Your mortal enemy. The cat. It was the cat, wasn't it? You don't like cats, so you're going to sacrifice the cat. What possessed you to make such a stupid vow? And Jephthah in the grandstand would hang his head and go, yeah, I know. This is why he made the vow. He was really good at negotiating. He negotiated a deal with the elders of Gilead. He negotiated a deal with the king of the Amorites. He was really good at negotiating deals. He sensed that God was with him, that he was using the skill that he'd learned, and he was on a roll, so he made a deal with God. You let me win, I'll sacrifice anything that comes out of my door. Jephthah's saying, if I could take anything back, it would be that, because that was the stupidest thing I did. You may never make a vow like that, but you may be like me. I can make a deal. I've done some really good deals over the years. I've got a reputation. Some of the deals were really good for the church. Some of them were really good for the family. In fact, all of them were okay for me or the family. But some of the deals I did, I look back now and go, they were plain dumb. I did it because I could. Not because it would bring God glory. Not because it wasted time, money, and effort that I could have poured into the advancement of the kingdom. But no, I was busy doing car deals and deals on this and deals on that. Jephthah says, watch the stupid meter. And he's not the only one to have had the stupid meter fly into action. Do you notice who he sits with? Barak, David. Barak was a man that was promised glory by God himself. But the stupid meter kicked in, and so a woman took his glory. King David, in his middle age, didn't go off to war when all the kings went off to play. He was walking on his roof and just looked out on his neighbour's house and said, "Who is that woman bathing there?" And you think, "What, are you thick? Do you think we're thick, David? You know exactly who she is. She is the wife of one of your 30 mighty men. You've stood with Uriah. You battled with Uriah. You shed blood with Uriah. Uriah is one of your closest allies. You know exactly who she is." But the stupid meter kicked in. And so he had an affair with her, had adultery with her, a child of the, as a result of that died, and King David, to try and catch, cover up his tracks, sent Uriah to the forefront where everybody knows you don't go to that point. David's stupid meter kicked in twice over, and he killed a man, and he had adultery with another, with a woman. Plain stupid. Watch the stupid meter. David sits with Jephthah, and David, I think, would want to take the microphone at this point and say, when the stupid meter goes in, go to God. Don't run away from him. I know you want to run away, but don't do that. Run to him. That's what I did. And he wrote Psalm 51 to tell us how he ran to God and begged for mercy. When the word of God exposes us, when the stupid meter goes off, run straight ahead to the Father, for he will pour mercy and grace on you one more time. Isn't that what the writer of the Hebrews wrote in Hebrews 4, where he says, the word of God is like a double-edged sword. It exposes us. But don't run away from God. Run to him. Go to the throne of grace in your time of need to find mercy and grace in your time of need. Because the one who knows the worst in us is the same one who wants to welcome us home, who keeps saying to us, no matter what you've done, no matter what you've become, there's a place to call home. So come. Come home. Third thing Jephthah would say to us is this. To run audaciously doesn't mean success. Not necessarily. Faith is not an autoimmune system. The call to run audaciously is the call to do something uncomfortable, something inconvenient. It's to talk to a neighbour about Jesus. It's to get reconciled to someone. It's to offer forgiveness to someone who has pained you in ways that others should never experience. You see, salvation is free, but obedience is costly. And so the writer here in verse 35 reminds us, Hebrews 11:35, that there were others, apart from Jephthah and David and so on, there were others in verse 35 who were tortured and refused to be released. They were tortured on the rack. It meant that they were stretched backwards over a drum, and so that their muscles, their stomach was exposed tight, and they were beaten like a drum until the muscle walls in their stomach collapsed and they died. One person like Pontius Pilate, his name was Flaccus, would do this, marching the person on a platform through a symphony or an orchestra while it played. Each of these people, they could have escaped their deaths if they wanted to, but they refused because they resolutely decided to honour Jesus, to run audaciously. One of them was a 90-year-old man called Eleazar, stretched out over a drum, beaten like a drum. In his dying breaths groaned, "It is clear to the Lord in his holy knowledge that though I might have been released from death, I'm enduring terrible sufferings in my body through this beating, but in my soul I am glad to suffer these things because I know Jesus." Some faced jeers and flogging while others were chained and put in prison. Some were stoned, some were sawn in two, some were put to death by the sword, and some went around in sheepskins and goatskins, and the world was not worthy of them, the writer says. They wandered in deserts and mountains and in caves and holes in the ground. These people were not successful. But, verse 39 says, they were all commended for their faith. They ran audaciously. And now they sit in the stand. And at this point, I can't help but wonder if one of them wants to grab a microphone. Maybe the guy's got two seats because he was sawn in two. Maybe he wants to grab the seat, the microphone, and speak to us. wait. You get to worship in that really nice building of yours and stand and sing songs about Jesus, and there's no government officials amongst you who are threatening to take away your home or your car. You get to do that, right? There's no government official threatening to close down your business or send you away from Australia. Is that right? You can pray, but the army's not here spraying machine gun bullets around. And anyone who survives, they're not going to take you up to the piazza later today and stretch you over a wheel and beat you like a drum until you die. Do I get that right? Is that right? I mean, you have freedom. You have education, yes, and money and health. And you don't run audaciously. What is that? Is that post-traumatic faith disorder? Is it OH&S mentality? Are you comfortable? And then they might say, we ran audaciously. And we didn't succeed, and we didn't get what God promised us. In fact, verse 40 in your Bible says that God won't let us go into the city just yet because he's waiting for you to finish your race so that together we can go into the city. So we're waiting for you. Run. Be audacious in every area of your life. Run so the world knows that you run for Jesus. Run. They say. And they might just go back to Hebrews 10 verse 32 and say, remember those earlier days after you received the light when you stood your ground in the great contest of the faith of suffering. Sometimes you were publicly exposed to insult and persecution. Other times you stood side by side with those who were so treated. You sympathized with those in prison and you joyfully accepted the confiscation of your property because you yourselves knew that you had lasting and better possessions. So don't throw away your confidence. It will be richly rewarded. You need to persevere so that when you've done the will of God, you will receive what is promised, and we're waiting for you. Run, for in just a little while, he who is coming will come soon. So run. Don't shrink back. Run, because we are not of those who shrink back and are destroyed, but we are those who believe and are saved. And so therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance. Let us run audaciously the race that is marked out for us.